Yeah, this has been an experiment for the last couple of years. It was initiated by Rossa there, who's heading up country, so we've made a bit of an effort to come in. The Speaker's Corner, I think, goes... It is an attempt for people just to not demand things, but to actually be the dream, because media, like most things, has been turned into a commodity controlled by elites. I'm from Australia, and the top media magnate, Kerry Packer, just died a week ago. He never paid any tax. And the other guy that comes from Australia is Rupert Murdoch, who went international to China and the United States, etc., and owns The Sun and Sky News and stuff like that. So what the media does, and Robbie mentioned it before, the actual essence, you know, of the media, of course, is to make money. And what the commodity they actually sell is our attention span. They gather your attention, like I'm gathering it now, and then they sell that as a commodity to corporations to get you to buy stuff you don't need. Okay, so they grab your attention, whether it's through mud wrestling or MTV or football, and then they sell that commodity on. And that's the primary essence of the media. It's not a social service. A lot of people who get involved in struggles for peace and justice think that the media is somehow objective, and that if we do the right thing, we can get on TV and tell our story. There's been an incredible censorship about Shannon Airport. 330,000 US troops passed through this airport last year in a country that claims to be neutral. That's double of the year before. People kind of think of the war as a past tense thing. The situation at Shannon will revert to normal. But you've basically got a US base in your country now. And the US, of course, is involved in a number of wars throughout the globe. And unlike the Vietnam War, which I grew up in that context, this is a war where the other side can actually hit back. And they've hit back at the Australians involved in this war in Bali. They've hit back in Madrid. They've hit back in New York. They've hit back in London. And they'll probably hit back in Ireland as well. And I don't think scaring people is a great motivation to get them active against this war. I think we should oppose this war because it's illegal, it's immoral, and it's unwinnable, if you haven't got any sense of morality or legality. 3 years ago, at this time, that the Pope took a stance that Kofi Annan took to say that this war was wrong and that we wouldn't have anything to do with it. And we found ourselves in a situation 3 years ago where the government was obviously not carrying out its responsibilities, where the Garda Síochána was not carrying out its responsibilities. So five of us decided to act non-violently and directly, and on February the 3rd, 2003, we made our way to Shannon Airport. We cut our way into that airport, and we made our way into a hangar, and we found a US Navy warplane. It had US Navy, and we know what the US Navy was doing. It was enforcing these sanctions that were killing children. It was about to escalate a major bombing campaign over Iraq. And with simple household hammers, we began to bash this plane and began to try and mould it into a ploughshare. It's a prophecy in the Old Testament to beat swords into ploughshares, which we thought was a good idea at the time. And the five of us disabled this plane, and then we prayed. We had photographs of Iraqi children with us. We had a Quran and a Bible. And when the cops turned up, we invited them to join us. We said, you're a human being. You can either go along with business as usual and be responsible for deaths of many children, or you can join us in demilitarising this airport and grounding this piece of military hardware. Unfortunately, they didn't accept our invitation, and we're handcuffed and taken to Limerick Prison. Actually, I just met a guy sleeping rough up here who was in prison with me 3 years ago. He said hi. Prison is a very... You know, I spent 2.5 years in prison in Australia and the United States and here now. And it's a very interesting place to view your society from. Because who you meet in prison are not the wealthy, are not the powerful. In Australia, the last jail I was in Darwin, the prison was 90% Aborigine, you know. The staff was 95% white. In Texas, I was arrested in New York State for disarming a B-52, put on Conair and flown to Texas, and put her in a county jail in the outback. I was the only white guy in the jail. There were 24 of us in a cage, 6 cages welded together. It was run by a private corporation that was making money out of incarceration.
What were they called?
They were called Correction Corporation of America. I think they're owned by Wackenhut now, who own Group 4. And they're the same ones who run the gulags for asylum seekers in the Australian outback. There were 1.5 million people when I was in jail in the United States in 1992. There are now 2.5 million people in jail in the United States.
Land of the free.
Yeah. And the first night I spent in jail when I was in my 20s in a maximum security prison in Australia, I was sharing a cell with a career armed robber. And he said to me that people will stop robbing banks when banks stop robbing people. And I thought that was incredibly insightful and probably an insight I would not have heard unless I'd gone to prison. And what it points to is that there are two sorts of crime in our world. There's high crime and there's low crime. There's wholesale terrorism, wholesale theft, and wholesale killing, and wholesale dealing in dangerous substances, whether that be drugs or radioactive substances. And that's done by governments and corporations. And that's protected by the military and by the law. And most people you meet in jail aren't in there for heroically rebelling against that system. They're in there for mimicking the system. They haven't been born with the birthright of George Bush and Dick Cheney to kill and to thieve, but they've tried their luck anyway. But they've been forced through their situations of poverty and in the Aboriginal experience to the total devastation of their society to get by in any way possible. So I think that's a very, very clear insight, because somehow on the media, you know, which is run by Murdoch, that when you park a car with a bomb in it in the street and detonate that bomb, that is terrorism. So if you drop that bomb from a B-52 or an F-16, or if you're a pilot who takes off from an aircraft carrier and kills people and doesn't see the blood, doesn't smell the fumes, and is back for lunch on his aircraft carrier, that's somehow not terrorism. That's foreign policy. That's military technique. And that's why it's very important, whatever media you encounter, whether it's this one, we had an interjection there, this one, or Rupert Murdoch's, you have a critical disposition to it. You say, who's writing this? What's their agenda? And what is the truth here, you know? And it was interesting. I was in London a day after it was bombed in July. I was in Ireland the day before, total alibi. It was really weird. I was on the tube system, and as I went through that tube system, I knew there were, you know, tens of people dead, still in the tube tunnels, being eaten by rats, basically. The London subway system, of course, is full of rats. And it was quite surreal. It was quite surreal to be there, because you knew Blair expected this. You knew Blair was warned by the mayor of London when he went into this war that London will pay the consequences of the British invasion of Iraq. And you know that Blair, for the last 3 years, had been preparing for the aftermath of the bombing of London. And what he did was rush through all this authoritarian legislation that actually restricts dissident voices, that totally pushes the Muslim community into a kind of internal retreat away from political activity, as you know, pretty much what happened to the Irish community in London in the 1980s. He had all that set up ready to go. And I believe that Ahern knows that there's a good chance that Dublin will be bombed. But given this, you know, it's probably unlikely to be Shannon. It's probably unlikely to be the aviation building. It's probably likely to be the fuck transport system you've got here. That's in total gridlock. And he knows that, and he's factored that in. He's saying we're willing to take that risk, and if there's an opportunity following that, we will have all sorts of legislation to dovetail in there. And last night, 200 people gathered at Shannon Airport. It's the largest kind of presence there for quite a while. And to say this is still a crime, what's happening here, and it's not going away, it's getting worse. Now, the 330,000 US military pass through this civilian airport in the past 12 months is an abomination. We were brought to trial twice last year. We've been charged with $2.5 million criminal damage without lawful excuse. We believe we had a lawful excuse to disable this warplane. We were brought to the four courts. We're facing a maximum of 10 years in jail. In the first trial, the judge was so biased that when I gave evidence, the first 7 objections to my testimony did not come from the prosecutor, whose job it is to object. The first 7 objections came from the judge, who's supposed to be like an impartial referee. And when the prosecutor made an objection, the judge said to him, I've been waiting for you, you know? I've been waiting for you. This judge was so vulgar and so prejudicial that on the fourth day, in his arrogance, he acted illegally and had to step down. And we were put back on bail, brought back to trial on October 24th. On the first day of our trial, the jury was chosen, a woman was chosen, and she got up and said, excuse me, I just remembered my daughter is an air stewardess with Aer Lingus. It might look like it'd be prejudiced if I was on this jury. And we said, look, ma'am, really congratulate you on your integrity. The judge said, I too congratulate you on your integrity. We had 10 days of trial, incredibly expensive for the state and for ourselves. On the 10th day, the judge said, we're not going to let the jury entertain the idea that you had a lawful excuse. And we said, we've just heard that you're a good friend of George Bush's, that you were invited to Texas to meet him when he was governor. You were invited to two inaugurations. How dare you sit on this trial and pretend you're objective? And the guy was so humiliated and scampered so quickly out of that courtroom, he forgot to put a media gag on that decision. So that's the second trial that's collapsed.
But the media haven't taken advantage of that.
Is that?
The media haven't taken advantage of that.
The media in Ireland, in relation to this war, are in a state of self-censorship. You know, an incredible state. There were two lies said about us when we acted. Two government ministers, the defence minister and the transport minister, both said that we assaulted and hospitalised a member of the Garda Síochána who was in that hangar. The reality was, we got in the hangar, the cop was asleep, we woke him up by hammering on the plane, he got out of the car, and he was having a stress attack, and he basically said, I'm going to lose my job. And we said, well, you can join us, we're going to stop the war. He wasn't really excited about that employment opportunity. And we basically comforted him. And when he got up in court under oath twice this year, he said that I personally comforted him while he was having a stress attack. Now, the two government ministers who lied about us have never retracted their statement, totally compromised any possibility of us having a fair trial. They also said we cost the Irish taxpayer $2.5 million, or €2.5 million, through our action. There is no obligation of the Irish government to pay for repairs of the US military warplane. There is no evidence that they did. Yet this is brought out and trotted out, these two ways of spinning public opinion against us, that we're somehow a crazy, violent people. And the day after we acted, Ahern sent the Irish army in to defend the most violent and the largest killing machine in human history against the non-violent Irish peace movement. So it was a pretty weird occurrence, you know. And as Robbie points out, none of this is teased out and investigated by the media. So we go back to trial on July 5th. We've been on bail for 3 years. The first year I spent on bail, we all spent on bail. We had to sign on every day at Pierce Street Garda Station. We were banned from County Clare. You know, peace activists banned from County Clare while the US military were quite welcome there. So that's kind of a surreal, Kafkaesque situation we still find ourselves in, you know.
What's human rights in relation to having to be tried a third time?
It's my opinion that if it was just the Irish government dealing with this, they know they can't convict us. Eight of the jury, when this collapsed, came and congratulated us. We got Christmas cards from two of them, right? It's pretty obvious they can't get a conviction. In their own self-interest, they should drop the charges. Now, why they're prosecuting us is because the US Embassy is demanding we're prosecuted. Having been a prisoner of America, the US never draws a line under anything. They just arrested a guy in the United States who went AWOL in 1964 from the Vietnam War. The detective that pursued him was born 5 years after he went AWOL, you know? They're still chasing people down from the 60s. They don't draw a line under anything, they don't forgive and forget, you know? And it's incredible bullshit when the Irish government comes out and said, why are you making a fuss about Shannon? It's always been like this. We did this during the Vietnam War. And somehow that's some kind of historical precedent that the Irish government could be proud of. 2.5 million Indo-Chinese died in that bloodbath, that massacre, that high-tech B-52 assault on their country. 53,000 young Americans died there. More than 53,000 committed suicide on coming back from that war. Now, I spent 3 years on the streets in America working with homeless people and met many Vietnam veterans abandoned by their government. I met many Vietnam veterans in the prison systems of the United States. They use these young people, exploit them, and wreck their lives, and then send them back to their families to create mayhem. And the reality is, who's been shipped through Shannon? And having met them, having met Kelly Doherty, a member of the US National Guard who came to testify on our behalf in March, who was in Iraq for 6 months as a military policewoman, having met Jimmy Massey, a US Marine who'll be back in Dublin this month, whose unit killed 30 civilians at checkpoints in Iraq, totally outside the parameters of the Geneva Convention, who are told to treat every Iraqi as a potential terrorist and to shoot first, ask questions later, if at all. Now, having met these people, you know that the people who join the National Guard are joining it because they are the working poor in America that have to survive by holding down that second or third job, that know that they can't afford college tuition unless they join the National Guard. They're not professional soldiers. They get 1 weekend of training a month, 2 weeks a year, and 40,000 of them are in a war zone in Iraq. And who sent them there were Bush and Cheney, who avoided service during the Vietnam War. Cheney got 3 deferments. Bush got shipped off to the Texas Air National Guard because the National Guard weren't deployed during Vietnam. And what cynicism that these rich elitists send the working poor off to do their dirty work and pay the consequences. And, you know, Ireland really has to come to some sense of moral, you know, maturity to say no. You know, the government's response is, oh, we can't have an independent foreign policy or the Americans might get upset and we'll suffer economically. Well, don't pretend you're an independent country. Give this whole bullshit about 1916 a rest, you know. And, You're a suburb of the USA, like Australia. But if you're going to say you're an independent country, have the maturity to have an independent foreign policy. This war has no popular support. It has no popular support in the United States. It has no popular support here or in Britain. The frightening thing is that now they can have wars without popular support.
Right.
All they need is our silence and our sedation at the centres. You know, whether it's Sydney, whether it's London or here or DC, all they need is our resignation, you know, to say, what can we do, you know? And as they get on with sacrificing their young, you know. So it's important that 200 people went down to Shannon Airport last night, and we should treat that not with a sense of cynicism, we should treat that with a sense of hope. And this is a very long war, and we have to build from the bottom again to oppose it. It is a war that can come home, you know. It's a war that's come home to Australians and Bali, tourist destinations. It's come home to Madrid. It's come home to London. And it's very understandable. You know, when the British military occupied the north here in the 70s and 80s, they created a generation of people who were willing to go and blow the fuck out of London, risking long years in jail, risking possible death. It's not a strange culture that produces people willing to take those risks. Those people take those risks because their families have been humiliated, their homes have been destroyed, and there's some sense of saying, you know, I am a human being and there's going to be payback. And I don't agree with that. I'm a radical Christian myself. But it's quite understandable why people do that, you know. And as Peter Ustinov said, war is the terrorism of the rich. Terrorism is the war of the poor. And we got to wake up and smell the coffee, you know. But all they want us to be...
Fair trade coffee, yes.
All they want us to be is consumers. They don't want us to be citizens. They don't want us to gather like this and to debate and work out what's happening in our society, in our city. They want us to think the only freedom we've got is the choice between Coke and Pepsi, Reebok and Nike.
Finnafile, Finnegale.
Lazier run Man U and what's his name, running Chelsea. They think that they're the only choices we've got at the point of consumption. And it's important for us to rediscover citizenship, to rediscover that there are elements of human freedom besides buying stuff, you know. And
can I just interject there?
Yep.
First of all, just to point out, I would like to bring you back to the fact that you rubbished 1916. What happened in this island in 1916?
No, I didn't. I rubbished the government. The government.
You're in the shadow of the building where most of the actions against the Irish people were perpetrated,
yeah.
And most of the actions that were taken against our citizens in the execution were actually considered and plotted through in the press.
Can I clarify that first?
In the second instance, you said that... In the second instance, you referred to the British occupation of the North of Ireland in the 70s and 80s. I would like to clarify further for your own information, which I'm sure you know. They are still an occupation of the northern part of Ireland.
Yeah.
So that's a good thing. And my main question, having quite both to the issues out to you, is can I ask you, seriously, because you're a brilliant speaker, I'm fairly enjoying what you're saying, and because it's all true, is... in the Middle East now, in the Israeli situation now, with the change of premiership in Israel, how do you see that affecting America's stance, which they must be absolutely nervous as hell over, and how do you see the American stance, the British stance, and the world stance standing in respect of the new selection of the new Premier of Israel?
Okay, there's a few things there. Okay, one is I don't rubbish 1916. I'm saying I'm rubbishing the government's exploitation of that creation myth. You know, and just like the church's exploitation of the crucifixion and resurrection of Christ, I'd rubbish the church bureaucrats. What's that? No, okay, we're not a myth. I'm rubbishing the exploitation of that. Just like Jerry Falwell exploits the life of Christ, okay? Not rubbishing Christ for 1916. Secondly, this is a petitioned
Where's Netanyahu, though?
Where's
Netanyahu?
And I think colonization is a very deep thing. I think, and the colonization here has been going for 800 years. I mean, Aboriginal people who I grew up with were colonized for 200 years, right? You've had 600 more years than they have. And it's a spiritual thing, it's an economic thing, it's a psychological thing. And people internalize. You know, say Aboriginal people I grew up with, they hated their looks, they hated their skin colour, their hair, etc. like that, because they'd internalised the colonizer's perspective of beauty, you know?
Like Michael
Jackson. Self-hatred and the self-harm, and it was terrible, you know? So I think a lot of that's in Ireland, too, you know?
We are still colonized, we're fair.
Yeah, even if you have a free...
That
even if you have a free state, or even...
We don't have a free state.
Okay. The internalized colonization is very, very deep, and it really needs a kind of exorcism, which might take a life.
The question is, who would we be colonized at the moment? By? We're just part of the empire. History has shown that empires come and go, and empires can go. You can't be can you? Was there ever a Camelot? Assumed that there was a time when things were happening. There were never
Time. Some entities, some of the colonizing entities are not even governments. There's Starbucks, Coca-Cola, and Nike.
It's empire. But the history will tell you that empires
have always been. Yeah.
Right, and it's how, okay, for the Christian, the question is, how do you be a human being in that historical context?
It's kind of almost Camelot idea. There was never a Camelot.
I haven't got a Camelot
idea. Look, what I'm saying here is, you criticise, right?
Yeah.
It's very easy to criticise.
Yeah.
Very easy for me to point out the faults of others.
Right.
What do you suggest?
Well, okay.
I mean, what do you really suggest?
I'll try to be real.
How do you actually...
I'll give you a brief response to that, okay?
Do you agree with prisons? What do you do if you don't have them?
Okay.
How do you control drugs if you don't have drugs?
Right.
How do you...
Okay, I'll briefly put my position... try not to bore you with that, okay? My position is I'm a radical Christian. Radical is Latin for returning to the roots. So I'm an anarchist and a pacifist, okay?
Yeah.
And I believe that we'll create an image of God that we can live with in a context of love rather than ripping each other off, and that there should be, that's an opportunity for all of us, whether we're in Ireland or whether we're in Iraq or whether we're in Colombia or whatever. So, yeah, it's to be the reality now.
But are you saying that the evil in the world is man-created or whatever? Is there not a kind of a nature there that... we don't really have incredible control over.
We have free will. We have free will to cooperate.
Indians go back to the Shaman and the
I'm trying to get back to the third question here. But we have free will. We have free will to ignore what's occurring on a daily basis, 900 troops through Shannon Airport, and to learn to live with that and be blind to that and deaf to that and dumb to that, you know? Or we got to, if we want to be fully human, we have to say, look, we're part of this, and we have to respond to it, you know, in some way. And, yeah, I believe in trying to live the reality of, you know, love and all that kind of stuff, and that requires engaging people who are hurt most by this, the homeless, prisoners, the dying, etc., and to confront the principalities and powers, the governments and corporations that cause poverty and death. Okay, that's a radical Christian perspective.
Do you believe this has gone on
you know what? Grow your own.
It has gone on in the
world. Yeah. And
it has gone on. Has
what do you mean?
This is just path. It's just a continuity.
Yeah, but I believe in the life, life, death, and resurrection of Christ. I believe that it's a human possibility to live in a just and loving way. In whatever context you find yourself in, whether they put you in a jail in Texas, whether they put you on bail in Dublin, whether it's back in Australia, as a human being, existentially, you've got a choice to decide things ethically and act on them as best as possible. And then if you do that,
you'll
run up against the state.
But what about the state? I mean, do you agree with the idea of the state? Do you agree with the idea of a government? Do you even agree?
No, I think Christianity went downhill when it signed up with the state in the 3rd century, when Constantine, the Emperor of Rome, legalized us, patronized us, and it went from within 100 years of being illegal to be a Christian in Rome to being illegal not to be one, to no Christians joined the Roman military, so you had to be a Christian to be in the Roman military. That's where things got screwed up in my tradition, 1,700 years ago. I would suggest that people, you know, every dissident movement, whether it's trade unions or Irish republicanism or punk rock, faces these co-options that Jesus faced, you know, power, wealth and status. And the co-option of any dissent is always a possibility. You know, when I was growing up, Johnny Rotten. You know, who'd believe that Johnny Rotten could be co-opted? The guy had green hair and green teeth and was way out. And now he's selling real estate in Malibu. You know, they can co-opt any dissident movement.
You see that as a fundamental corruption. To me, Johnny Rotten had been corrupted long ago. His soul was corrupted. I mean, you automatically...
I thought he had some good tunes, eh?
You automatically assumed that in embracing consumerism or something was the ultimate evil. I think he had far bigger problems than just that.
I think he was a prophetic voice in the 70s. He was a prophetic voice. Just like some of the people occupying the positions of power now.
He was a boy band.
What's that?
He was a boy band.
The boy band. The Monkees of the 70s. Well, there's different debates.
Malcolm McLaren.
Yeah, Malcolm McLaren was the Svengali.
Your ignorance is almost politely naivety and almost romantic about your ignorance of Irish history, so I'd like you to leave that out of the rest of the conversation, because clearly you're not as informed maybe as you should be to address the issue. I pick up what this chap has made some very good points. Could I bring
what
you back again?
You're talking about 1916. Again?
Yes, well, right through to the fact that you're left out.
I'm from a family that you probably are, of people who participated in that kind of armed struggle. I understand that and respect it.
May I finish my real question? But you left out the fact that, you know, you mentioned that Ireland was only an occupation up in 1980s.
No, I was talking about when they were fighting back. Militarily, in London.
The fight back would never end, I can assure you on that one. Maybe we don't through different means by now, but it will never end. So I would suggest you leave the Irish question maybe out of your arguments with respect on power.
The example I was using was when people were fighting back militarily, when London was being bombed by people from Ireland.
Well, I assure you the ceasefire did not end in 1990, so there was no ceasefire in 1990. So, as I said, leave the Irish part of the political struggle and the armed struggle out of your curricular endeavours this afternoon, I would suggest to you.
His perspective is very informative. I don't agree with you.
Having said that, your views on our neutrality or otherwise on Channel Airport is quite correct and quite valid. But could I bring you back again, just to my final question?
Yeah.
The Middle East question under Israel and the
Jewish. More ignorant of the Middle East. I'm reading Robert Fisk's book at the moment. I'm from... You know, like there is, I'd say there's very direct links. Like a good friend of mine, Cuiva Butterley, who's in the occupied territories, who was shot in the leg for taking school children to school by the Israeli Defence Forces, who fasted for a week outside this cement company in Dublin that's providing most of the cement for this wall, the apartheid wall they're building. she'd be a better person to ask. But I think there's, whatever context you find yourself in, there are non-violent responses, you know. And I don't agree. I think violence has an implicit authoritarian politics with it, you know. And, I can understand why people are driven to violence and resort to violence, but I don't think it's got much to change. I think it's got a lot to revenge and payback, and I can understand where that's coming from. And, you know, my family history is no stranger to that either, you know. But I'm personally a Christian. I don't expect everyone else to be. And Christ, of course, was in a third world, colonized, occupied setting, and had a lot of former unstruggled people in his group. So I wouldn't... I believe the just war theory is incorrect, and it emerges in the 3rd century with the sellout of radical Christianity.
Okay. Israel
looks like an... I don't know, someone got a blank check for Nazism there.
Yeah.
You know...
from now.
It looks like a racist entity, doesn't it?
But any change from the original?
I'd like to talk about Israel.
Yeah, he's... Happy again.